to a special edition of Breaking Badness. In this bonus episode, you'll hear from Kimberly Price, founder and CEO of Zadig Security. We'll talk with Kimberly a bit about her background and her passions within InfoSec. This bonus episode of Breaking Badness is next. Welcome to our special episode of Breaking Badness, recorded on April 16th, 2024. I'm excited to speak with Kimberly Price today. I'm your host, Callie Fensel. Kimberly, we're so excited to have you on the podcast. Welcome.
Thank you so much. I'm excited to be here.
I actually, to catch up a little bit on your background, I listened to you on a few other podcasts. So you're a podcast regular, I take it?
I do a few from time to time.
Okay, cool. Well, we appreciate you joining us today on Breaking Badness. Just to get started, something that brings me joy in this series of the podcast, this is our Voices from InfoSec series for any new listeners out there. So we like to talk about our guests' journey into the InfoSec world. So sometimes that's not linear given how this industry is. So how did you catch the security industry bug?
So what's funny is my background is behavioral psychology and public health education. But I've always been very computer adjacent. So in college, one of my college internships, I was developing the website for a local public health organization in the town I lived in. And so, this was back in the days of using HTML in, Netscape to build a website with a little construction worker, under construction logos and things. So I've always been very active in computers, bulletin board systems. I ended up in my first job for the health department being the person who did all of the IT support. When the IT department didn't want to send somebody out to our building, they'd be like, hey, can you go update these settings on somebody's computer for us? And so I would do that for them. I ended up moving to the Seattle area and doing some temp work that turned into full-time work at Microsoft in an HR capacity. It was something to do. And I was new to the area. And what ended up happening is I ended up recruiting for security. I was there during the Bill Gates Trustworthy Computing Memo and the creation of the security business unit. And I was so excited about this because computers are only useful if they're networked and they're secure. Otherwise, you just have a big fancy word processor on your desk. And this was in the 2001 to 2003 timeframe. And so I actually argued with my leadership team that I want to support the security business unit that's being created. And I happened to also be supporting the Windows networking team. And I'm like, I'll keep Windows networking, but I don't want to do these other pieces of the business anymore. I want to do security because this is really interesting to me. And they agreed and let me do that. And about a year later, one of the teams I supported said, we're building out this new team, this new role, which is designed to build better relationships with security researchers. Security researchers are dropping vulnerabilities on the internet. We're having to launch our emergency response process. It'd be really great if they would just report them to us and let us fix them, which is, as listeners may recognize, the concept of coordinated vulnerability disclosure. Microsoft had a security response team at the time, but not all the security researchers wanted to work with the Microsoft security response team. And this manager said, you would be really good at that. And that was my transition from HR into working in the security business unit as a program manager, developing the security outreach program, which is similar to like a DevRel program, because it was very engineering focused more so than marketing. There was no Twitter at the time. I didn't have sentiment analysis. It was very much, how do we build relationships with security researchers to get better outcomes for customers around the world?
Gotcha. Gotcha. That's really cool. When you said that you wanted to do more with security and you wanted to lead that, what, like, was there any pushback, or, you know, were they convinced immediately?
Well, so in HR, it was funny because no, my leadership team thought that continuing to support the Windows Server division would be better for my career long term. And I'm like, maybe it would be better for my career long term, but I'm not a career HR person. I was only doing it because it was a thing to do when I moved to the Seattle area. I wasn't just so passionate about doing HR and recruiting type work that I was like, yeah, and then maybe I can be a vice president of HR. No, that was never my thing. And so I was like, it may not be good for my career, but I like it. I'm more interested in it. So I want to go do that. And they eventually said, okay, you asked for it. I think it turned out okay.
No, yeah, absolutely. It sounds like it. Like, when you make a jump like that from HR to security, like, you know, what, like, how did you prepare for that? I'm sure there's a number of people out there that would love to make a jump like you did. So what would you recommend?
So this was 2003. There were no security boot camps. There were no college courses on application security. It was much, much earlier in the industry. And so companies, you had people who were doing security as a hobby, and some people who had turned it into a business. But I was very fortunate to have a leader that I mentioned, this manager. He was the general manager of the MSRC. And he believed in me and he took a chance on me because I didn't have a computer science degree. I didn't, I wasn't an engineer. I didn't know how to write code. But what he needed this program to be was gamification. It was advocacy. It was understanding what motivates people and how can we shift culture and build relationships. It was all those soft skills things. And so before I even interviewed, he had me sort of pre-interview with a few key stakeholders on the team to be sure that when I went through the full interview loop, these internal team leaders were going to be on board and that they believed in me. But it also helped me deal with my jitters and my imposter syndrome over, oh my gosh, like, I could be working in a product team. I could, like, maybe I'm not qualified, because the imposter syndrome was really hard. And so I, at multiple points in my career, that having a manager that believes in you and will advocate for you and will coach you and set you up for success has been instrumental. And to this day, I try to continue to pay it forward to other people because I know I have benefited from that personally in the past.
Absolutely. That's a lovely statement. Now that you have tenure within the community, do you feel like it's that there's a lot of that within the community, or do you think it could be improved upon?
What's interesting about the security community is how many people find their next job through their network and not from applying to websites. And so I do think there is still a very healthy, honestly, maybe sometimes unhealthy network effect. And it can be unhealthy when it's introducing selection bias, where you're only hiring people that you already know. And so, you know, it's something to always be sensitive to and continue to actively work against, to say, well, who do I not know that might be great at this? Who's in my friends of friends network? Who's in my friends of friends network? Who new could I meet at a conference or at a community event? And actively look for opportunities to diversify your networks.
Yeah, that's a good point. I guess what I'm curious about is, as somebody that, you know, currently works in marketing, and I enjoy marketing, but I also really enjoy the security research aspect of, you know, what we do at Domain Tools. You know, I would want, I would hope people would, you know, I'd have people like you, and I feel like I do, where, you know, they take a chance on you. Like, do you feel like there's enough of that, or there could be, or there could be more based on, you know, what I feel like you're saying, where, you know, maybe there's too much of, I'm hiring somebody I already know. Like, is there not enough of that taking chances on folks that could benefit?
You're absolutely right. There is not enough taking chances. And a lot of companies are not making space for training people up and hiring on potential and growing talent. When I do strategic organizational planning and I'm planning out my headcount for the next 2 years, yes, I always start with some of my more senior experienced positions that need to be filled. But then the next phase of hiring is, all right, who's more junior? Who has potential? Who is maybe making an adjacent career shift? And you can't fill half your organization with candidates of that profile. But you absolutely should always have at least one in your organization where you're like, you know what? This person doesn't have direct hands-on experience, but I see their potential. I have worked with someone who was, they were actually my recruiter at BlackBerry when I took the job there. And today they're the vice president of security. Like, they are now leading an entire security engineering organization because someone saw their potential and gave them a chance to come in as a program manager, and they worked their way up. I hired someone in my career at one point who was working as the office manager in a real estate office, and I hired her to be a community manager for a bug bounty program. And now she is running the company's customer success program, I believe. And so there are people who have core competencies and raw potential who are eager to learn and develop, and they just need a leader who's going to see that and invest in them and give them feedback and help them grow. People can do amazing things. And if I ever have an organization that doesn't have one or two people like that, chances are I'm looking for that one or two people to bring in, because it also helps my senior people grow. It puts them in a position of being able to mentor and remember, oh, right, not all of the stakeholders we engage with in a product team, in an IT team, not all of our customers will have the depth of knowledge and experience that we have. And we need to learn how to communicate with those audiences. And what better way to learn that communication style and learn how to teach security than to have someone on the team that you're teaching?
Yeah, absolutely. I think Our director of enablement, Tim Helming, who kindly lets me borrow his account when we're recording this, he would probably say the same thing. It's amazing to have people in house that can train up other people like myself to be able to use the tools and gain momentum. It's great. Like, I just feel like personally I'm growing a lot, and I love that you have the same sentiments. But it sounds like, you know, we've covered some key moments that have changed your career trajectory already, but are, you know, once you entered into the security realm, you know, are there any others that you'd like to share with our audience that, you know, changed your trajectory once you arrived in security?
So I've had a few big pivots in my career, which are really, it comes down to being open to possibility and opportunity that you don't necessarily expect. At one point, I had an opportunity to do actual threat hunting work where I was doing analysis and research and open source investigation on some internet criminals actually. And it was great and it was exciting and I loved it. And it also started making me really, really paranoid. And I realized, you know, this might not be the career field for me. And so I pivoted and I said, you know what, here's a thing that I haven't done yet and that I'd like to build skills in. And I'm going to actively work towards that. And that was being a security feature program manager. And so I went and did that for a little bit and discovered I don't actually like that. Like, that wasn't really my jam. It was in an established product team. They were working on version 8. And I'm more of a startup person. Even if it's an established company, I want to work on something that's breaking new trail and hasn't been done before. And so I said, all right, now what? Well, I haven't done mobile security. Let's go do that. And so I think for me, those pivots have come from trying to identify experiences I don't have and actively walking towards the discomfort and saying, I don't know this. Let's go.
Wow, that's so cool. Most people are risk averse, but it sounds like you really walk toward it, which is cool. How do you do that?
It is a little scary, I'm not gonna lie. And that's okay. It just comes down to believing that I'm gonna figure it out. And maybe what I figure out is I'm really good at this. And maybe I figure out I'm not really good at this or I don't enjoy this. And then I'll go figure something else out. Because the field of security is so broad. There are so many different things you could do. There was a point in my career where I absolutely did not want to manage people. I remember telling someone who said to me, you would be a great manager. And I said, oh, no, PowerPoint gives me hives. I don't want to just be a slide deck jockey. I like rolling up my sleeves and getting my hands dirty and doing the work. And now I can't imagine not leading a team and investing in the next generation of security leaders. And that's because I said, you know what? I haven't done management. I've always done incident response. I would like to, instead of just making the sausage, I would like to write a sausage cookbook. I have ideas on how we could do this better. And that means I need to lead a team. I need to be accountable for the decisions and the strategy and the scope. So I guess I'm going to go figure that out now. So I went into people management. And guess what? I love it. And I didn't expect that at all. So got to take those chances.
That's great. How often do you have to use PowerPoint?
Every day. No, not every day. not every day, but a lot. You know, it's funny because I have learned how to visualize data and how to visualize messages and leverage it for storytelling in ways that, you know, 15 years ago, I simply did not have that capacity. And when you use it as a storytelling tool to convey an idea, it can be incredibly powerful.
Cool. Very cool. On that same note of, you know, taking chances, and as I was lightly stalking you to prepare for this conversation, you mentioned on another podcast the importance of branding yourself, especially, and I think, you know, especially in the current employment climate, that's incredibly important. So I was wondering if you could share with our audience, how do you get comfortable with doing that? Because I think it's a hard concept for people to master.
It is. And even I struggle with it sometimes. For example, I know a lot of people who can give their friends great feedback on their resumes, but their own resumes are a dumpster fire. And I'm one of those people. I have a really hard time talking about myself. And it sounds weird to say, but it takes practice. It takes practice of how do I position not the activity, but the impact. And this is true whether you're talking about yourself on LinkedIn or trying to promote what you're working on LinkedIn so that it has visibility, or, you know, if you're using Blue Sky or Mastodon or whatever your social media tool might be, or if you're writing a resume or if you're writing a performance review. Your manager isn't going to care that you had 14 meetings this week. What they're going to care about is you delivered a thing that had impact to the business. And so as you start thinking about how do I communicate what I do, it just takes practice. And maybe trying to get out of your own head and think about, well, if this were my best friend and I were writing the post for them, how would I cheerlead my best friend? Or, you know, this person I work with that I think is awesome. If I were writing feedback for this person I think is awesome, what language would I use? Okay, can I apply that to myself? And that can help. I think one of the other challenges people have in talking about themselves and being self-promotional is this feeling that if I do good work, people will just recognize it and I shouldn't be showy and I shouldn't be flashy. And, you know, I don't want to draw attention to myself because that's crass or something. And if people don't know what you're working on, they don't know what you're working on. Somebody's got to tell them. And so just think of it as sort of like stakeholder updates. Here's what I'm working on that's really cool. Maybe think about what kind of question would you ask? This is the thing I'm working on that's really cool. Like, has anybody else worked on something like this? Or what do you think? Or what feedback can you get from other people that turn it less into let me show off versus let's have a conversation? Or instead of let me show off, hey, let me share what I learned so you can use this information too. And if you take a teaching approach, or if you take I'm going to help people approach, or let's have a conversation approach, it sometimes feels less yucky.
I like that a lot. I think that would resonate with people a lot more. When you were talking about I can't talk about myself this way because it's icky. Like, I'm just like, oh yeah, that resonates with me. I'm Midwestern and we can't speak about ourselves like that. It's very arrogant.
Right.
Yeah. Right. So I think that's great advice. One of the other things that you mentioned in that other podcast as well was, you know, the sharing relevant topics on LinkedIn and talking about it from that teaching element that you just mentioned, which I think is great. I have heard some feedback from other folks, maybe not necessarily in InfoSec, but just they want to participate on LinkedIn. But the thought is, well, what can I share that hasn't already been shared? Like, how would you respond to that?
Well, and I think this comes back to if you were at a conference in the hallway and somebody shared an idea that you agreed with, you would agree with them and you join the conversation and you'd be like, oh, totally. I saw that happen in my experience here with this thing and here's what we did. And then it becomes a dialogue. And so if you're on social media and there's somebody sharing an idea, whether, you know, you don't have to have had it first to join the conversation. And what's more, your audience, your network probably isn't 100% overlap with this other person's network. So you're bringing that idea to new people still that maybe wouldn't have seen it otherwise. And you're expanding the conversation. Maybe when you expand the conversation, you're translating it for your community, which may not necessarily sort of speak the same language, especially, you know, if there's a security topic and you're coming at it from a developer perspective, maybe you're that translation layer for folks. So yes, having original ideas is, you know, that hashtag thought leadership piece, but sharing ideas is still valuable and still brings value to your audience.
That's great. I think that's going to be very helpful to folks. I'm going to pivot just a little bit, just to get more into, you know, what your background, you know, in security. And so I'm going to start with, I read your dark reading bio that stated you pioneered the first security research outreach program in the software industry. And I was just hoping you could tell me a bit more about what that was and how it came to be.
Yeah. So I mentioned that I ended up going and working in the security group, and that was creating this program. And, you know, security researchers would drop vulnerabilities on dark reading, which is before Facebook and Twitter. It was a mailing list that had a website. And Microsoft would find out about vulnerabilities at the same time that all of the customers and the rest of the world did. And so they would end up having to do a security incident response to rapid triage, rapid remediate. And that urgency wasn't always commensurate with the risk. So you've got technical risk and you've got brand risk. And there could have been more severe technical issues in the backlog that didn't get worked on because of the exacerbated brand risk of this public vulnerability that maybe didn't put customers at as much technical risk, but had all eyes on it. And so it was not good for customers, and it also wasn't good for Microsoft. So I came in to an engineering organization with deep imposter syndrome, because here I am, a psychology major in an engineering team. And I started interviewing people in the security team, and I started reading about the researchers that were finding these vulnerabilities, understanding the severity of those vulnerabilities, understanding what were they reporting as vulnerabilities to other companies, and started building personas. And that is a marketing concept or a product management concept of what are the personas of researchers? What motivates them? What kind of work do they do? And then how can we build better relationships with them that are a win-win? So there was no concept of gamification at the time, but that's basically what it was, which was this incentive model of, if you have somebody who's really motivated to get their name on an advisory because that's going to help them get their next job, that is their motivation. But there's somebody else who doesn't care about getting their name on an advisory because they own their own security consulting company. They don't need the next job. What they would really benefit from is maybe they want an MSDN license, or they want to have a deep technical conversation with an architect. And so understanding these different personas and what their motivations are allowed us to build both one-to-one, and I'm sorry, I'm doing that terrible thing where I say us when it was I was building one-to-one and one-to-many engagement programs that would sort of give people what they needed, and Microsoft then got what they needed as well, which was a better working relationship with researchers that would do coordinated vulnerability disclosure with them. And it wasn't just do this because Microsoft wants you to and it benefits Microsoft. They were getting intrinsic rewards as well. They were getting what they needed to feel like, yeah, this is what I wanted out of this engagement or this relationship with this big vendor. And it came down to building trust and then maintaining trust over time. So that's how it started. And what ended up happening and was not expected by Microsoft, I expected it, but Microsoft did not expect that their internal culture was going to change. And the way they viewed researchers was going to change. And it started very adversarial. Why are these people being so mean to us? Can you make them be less mean? And helping Microsoft understand, it's not about being mean to you. It's really not. Like, their motivations aren't our motivations. Why would they be? They don't work for Microsoft, but that doesn't mean you can't have a healthy relationship. But we both sides had to change. And what's interesting is I carry that forward now into working across security and product teams, because the product team motivation and the security team motivation aren't always aligned, and the way they do things aren't always aligned, and you can end up with conflict between those groups, which you can fix if you develop trust.
It really sounds like your background in, studying psychology and then working in HR really come to focus when you tell that story. Like, that's it, like, it's very like building trust especially is important to that. And like, I just don't know if you know, somebody that doesn't have those skills would be able to do something like that.
I think they would. And I think that because I know several people who do that. I know someone who was a community manager in gaming. I actually know two people who are community managers in gaming who worked in free-to-play games and understanding what motivates their community to engage with the game is directly translatable to, I can understand how to work with people in security to get better outcomes. And so DevRel is the same thing. Anybody who has worked in one of those engagement type roles, whether it's somebody who's a developer who's just really good with people in a DevRel function, or more of the marketing community managers, there's a lot of different fields that can be very successful in this. You don't have to have a degree in psychology to be good with people.
Gotcha. Yeah, that makes sense too. That's perfect.
I do, though, want to quickly say it's not just, oh, I'm good with people, I can totally do this. There is a tradecraft involved. There are skills. In fact, there are communities for community managers where they share best practices and they share what works for them and what doesn't work and how do you measure success. And I have seen, unfortunately, engineering leaders typically who maybe don't value those soft skills. You know, they say soft skills in a sort of disparaging way, like, what, I have friends, I could totally run a community program. And it's like, no, it's not just having friends. It's more to it than I'm good at parties. It's understanding how do we actually structure this in a systemic, scalable, repeatable way? How do we measure success? How do we make it objective? There are a bunch of things that are actually involved. And so I don't want to make it sound like, you know, it's easy. It is still skilled labor, but it's skilled labor that you don't have to have a bachelor's of science in behavioral psychology to learn.
Mm-hmm. I gotcha. That makes sense. And I think that's great for folks to hear. I probably should have asked you this at the beginning. I was introduced to you by my colleague, Ian Campbell, and he had met you at the Art into Science, a conference on defense, and you had given a presentation there, which was titled DevSecOps is Dead, Long Live DevSecOps. And I was hoping, could you share more about that talk with our listeners? I was intrigued by the description where it was, the principles aren't hard, so why are we still failing?
Right. So in this talk, honestly, it's a very hard topic to say, look, this thing that we've all held up as the model, this shift left, we keep doing the same things and it's not actually all that successful for most companies. And we need to do a blameless retro and think about why. And so I talked about a bunch of the constructs of this shift left DevSecOps model that aren't working. Things like we throw a bunch of tools in the CI/CD pipeline, but they all have disparate dashboards that engineers don't go look at. The security team expects them to go look at them, but they're not going and looking at them. Or maybe they're not integrated ticketing straight into the developer workflow. Or the big one, the developers don't know how to interpret the outputs. They're like, well, if it's got red all over it, I guess I have to fix it. But if it's only orange, I can probably accept the risk maybe. And so we're pushing accountability to engineering teams without really thinking about their user experience, thinking about their capacity. So a lot of shift left is throwing tools into the dev pipeline, but that's during implementation. What about during the design phase? I see so many companies that don't even think about threat modeling until the final security review 2 weeks before they ship the product. And that's like reading the building code and designing your architecture at your building inspection. Like, the security team comes in and says, you know, that's a load-bearing wall, right? You can't build it that way. And the product team's like, well, the whole house is built now, so I guess we'll just like put in a beam here to help support it after the fact, or an extra pillar. And it doesn't work all that well. It's not elegant. It's not resilient. It's potentially a usability problem. Like, it's a bad outcome that they could have avoided with secure design in the beginning. And so those aren't working. Oh my gosh, there's just so many things. Like, security champions don't work. We say, let's have a volunteer workforce in the engineering team that'll be our security champion. But then we don't give them any training, and they don't really have a community. And their performance goals almost never include any security goals, because their job is still shipping product, delivering features, customer adoption. And so we're shifting the work without shifting support resources, and not really holding their leadership accountable for security deliverables. And so there's a lot of areas where I think DevSecOps is breaking. Because in this golden triangle of how we do anything as a project, you have fast, cheap, and good. And those three things are constantly pulling at each other. You can have fast and cheap, but it's probably not going to be very good. You can have good and fast, but it's going to be expensive. And so these things are constantly pulling. And so often DevSecOps is a fast and cheap solution that isn't really delivering good. And I think we need to revisit those trade-offs.
Absolutely. Yeah, as you were saying that, I was like, only two of those could be true at the same time. It's like,
right.
Yeah. So I guess, you know, from there, what would you in your talk, what would you propose when we're saying these things are failing, and, you know, we need to keep looking at these three elements that are pulling at each other? You know, is there a way forward, or is it just something that the community needs to work on together to get to that answer?
Well, in my talk, I joke that forget it, I'm done. I'm going to go live off the grid and raise baby goats. But
that doesn't sound so bad,
right? I haven't actually given up hope. But it is going to take change on the part of security teams and engineering teams, and leadership in both of those teams, quite frankly. The idea of let's shift left and downsize our security footprint and move those pieces into the engineering team, what ends up happening is a lot of engineering leaders are like, yay, I have more people. I'm going to go purpose them on features. And it's like, no, those are security like resources. You still have to do the security work. Just because we decentralized security doesn't mean you don't have to still have security. Like, and so that's a change that has to happen in engineering leadership, that if they're going to say, you know what, security is just engineering and I own engineering and therefore I should own security, then you have to own security. And those accountabilities have to be aligned with the leadership team, just like they're aligned to the CISO or whoever your security leader is. So that is a change that needs to happen in the engineering teams. But a change that needs to happen in the security teams is better user focus. And I don't only mean the company's customer, but I mean your developers. Creating those paved paths for them and being willing to be pragmatic and make trade-offs, and not just say you have to do it because security said you have to do it. We also need to change. And so these different pieces have to shift. As I have created programs where we're getting security teams to work with engineering teams, for the first couple months working with a new engineering team, they don't believe me when I say, hey, we're here to help. Bring me all your complaints about all the security teams you've ever worked with. Like, let's do the airing of grievances. Tell me what hasn't worked for you. I am new here. I am new to working with you. And I want to understand the pain you've had in the past so that we can come up with a plan to address it. And they don't actually believe that I'm going to help them. And when I say, hey, here's this thing we need to do, and they get upset and they say, we don't have resources for that. I'm like, cool, let's talk about what it would take to do it. And they think that frequently that like the security teams they've encountered in the past, I'm just going to shame them for not prioritizing correctly, where in reality, I might be saying, no, I totally agree. This is a really hard trade-off. Let's work together to go to our combined leadership teams and let them know we can do A or we can do B. We can't do both simultaneously. Which one would you like us to focus on? Alternatively, you could give us more resources and we could do A and B simultaneously, but like that's an option C, as it were. And they're just not used to having, and they're not used to having security teams that want to help them. We need to change that.
Is that where, would you say that's where Zadig Security comes in?
So last summer, I was interviewing with a number of companies, and all of the small companies were looking for a security leader. They were very excited to talk to me about coming in and developing their strategic roadmap and, you know, board reporting and also running vulnerability management hands-on and doing the next Log4j. And I'm just thinking, why would you pay my salary to run the next Log4j? That makes no sense. And when am I going to have time to do your board reporting and your strategic roadmap if I'm establishing a vulnerability management program that you don't currently have? Like, you actually need not me full time. You also don't need a vulnerability management like person full time. Like, you need a few people that have specialty skills. You need a general contractor for sure. You also need a Finnish carpenter, a plumber, an electrician. You need a few different skills here, but you don't need any of them full time. And so the idea that small companies can't really get that model today seemed to be a great opportunity. And that's where Zadig came from, which was, all right, I can build a dream team of great people, and then we can help multiple small companies simultaneously to get the best possible outcome with their resources. Now, the way we build it is, hey, let's start early in your DevSecOps journey. So it's just baked into your culture from the beginning. Of course you have SSO. Of course you have branch protection. You've had this from the time your company was 90, 100, 500 people. So when you reach the point that you're 1,000, 5,000, 10,000, you don't have all this latent friction of, well, we've never done it before. Why do we have to change now? Oh, we have to re-architect our whole CI/CD pipeline now. How do we do light lift pragmatic things with the tools you already have in place? How do we turn on and configure the right security features for you before you have a problem? How do we build it all in by design for a small company that enables them to grow? And that's what we're building. And I could talk nonstop about this because I'm really passionate about how do we help small companies that don't have 150 security people in their $100,000 employee company.
Yeah, that I love that. I hope you're passionate about it. I apologize. Did you start Zadig last summer, or when exactly did it start up?
So we were in stealth until October.
Okay.
So I went and I had a friend and former colleague who was kind of workshopping it with me. And I initially was thinking, you know, let's find an established consulting company that we could be a managed practice for. And they really wanted to do a startup. And so I went to another friend, and said, "You've done startups before. I'm really scared. And much like every other pivot in my career, I'm really nervous about this. And so can you tell me all the things that I shouldn't be nervous about that I am, but also can you tell me the things that I don't even realize yet?" And we had a great conversation. And by the end of that call, he said, "You know, I'd like to be a part of this as well, if you would like." And I was thrilled. And so my co-founders are Zach Glick and John Callis. John has founded a number of startups before, and we're just, you know, Zach and I are so thrilled to have him on this journey with us. But we workshopped it all through the summer. We launched the company in October of 2023, and it's just been growing nonstop because there is such a market need to help small and medium companies build out their first security program. And I think it helps that our goal is to not make companies dependent on us. You know, we want to get them up and running and set them up for success so that in a couple years' time, they have their own in-house security team that is, they don't need us. They've got it. They've got it under control. Maybe it's not a security team. Maybe it's integrated in their engineering function because their accountabilities are properly aligned. But we want to help them get started and then move on and help somebody else get started and help somebody else get started and help them be successful with the tools and the people that they have.
That's really cool. Yeah. So your business model is essentially you come in and then you Mary Poppins away when they don't need you right. anymore.
Right. Exactly. And what's interesting is we're finding, well, of course, you know, our focus is small to medium businesses. We're getting a number of more established companies who have their own security team and have a fairly mature process saying, "Hey, this secure developer experience, like, we think we can have a better relationship with our engineers. Could you come in and help identify areas where we could really improve our user experience and the secure developer experience?" And that's been really fun to do as well, because, you know, they're really bought into, we know we can get better outcomes, and you're not having to fight uphill and try to argue with, "No, really, trust me, like, these soft skill things, they matter." And they're like, no. How do we get the engineers to not, like, roll their eyes every time security shows up in a meeting and, like, suddenly get defensive? And I'm like, yes, I can help you with that. We can definitely do that.
That's awesome. And it sounds like even for being the CEO of the company, like, you still get to be hands-on like that.
I do. But what's interesting is because we're growing, we are adding to our team, and I'm very excited because that means that we can help more people. And, you know, that's exciting as well. So yes, I get to work directly with customers, which I absolutely love. But we're not blocked on my capacity, I guess is the way to put it.
That's cool. What would you say is the most surprising thing that you've learned in creating Zadig?
I think it's a little surprising to me, probably more surprising to listeners, which is how many companies are really struggling with blocking and tackling basics of security. They don't need red teams. They don't need threat hunting. They need identity access management and role-based access controls. They need branch protection. Like, they need some really important basic fundamentals in their product development environment, but also in their enterprise. And so just the universalness of how much these things are needed. And I think what we're hearing from our clients and what we're finding ourselves as we establish our own small business is there isn't a lot of really clear, step-by-step, pragmatic guidance that isn't trying to sell a solution. And it's really hard to trust, oh, here's how I can do XYZ thing for my business when XYZ thing is a solution a company is trying to sell you. Mm-hmm. And so we're finding this big gap in guidance that we're also looking to fill, and trying to figure out, okay, how do we help companies without actually trying to sell them anything? Don't get me wrong, if they want to pay us to go implement it for them, we would take it. But when we're doing our own security assessment of a solution, we're preparing those assessments in a way that we could publish them. And now any company can see, look, we reviewed these five service providers to make a choice for our company. Your mileage may vary, but here are the things we considered and what we ultimately went with and why. Mm-hmm. We don't sell any of these solutions, but how many companies could benefit from basically copying our notes? Like, hey, I finished the test already. Do you want to copy my notes?
You're trying to make it open book for people.
Exactly, exactly. And, you know, that can be challenging because we didn't pick all five vendors. There's going to be four vendors that are unhappy with the decision we made. But by showing our work and explaining why we chose the one we did and why it made sense for us, you know, if nothing else, maybe those other four vendors get an idea of features they should add to their roadmap to make them more competitive.
Yeah, absolutely. Would you say, you know, that's one of your goals in the next few years for your organization is to do things like that? Or what would you say the goals would be?
That is absolutely one of our goals. So while we were in stealth, we had time to really think about our values as a company. And one of our core values is giving back to the community and sharing our knowledge without it necessarily, you know, it's just goodwill. It's just paying it forward, helping companies, but also helping people coming up in their career to build leaders for the future. So we're working on a substantial content plan that we'll be launching in the next couple months.
Awesome. And would you say, and maybe this is my last question on the organization itself, but you know, kind of coming full circle, have you had the opportunity to pay it forward, like we had talked about at the top of the interview, where do you have those employees that you've taken a chance on and given them, yes, that opportunity to grow? Yeah.
So we have brought on an employee who is our business operations program manager, and they are learning and onboarding. And previously they worked for 6 years managing a team in a customer service call center. So from a core competency of program management, they managed a team of 27 call representatives. They're organized. They know how to follow up on things. They know how to get things done. And do they know security? No. Can we teach them? Absolutely. And they're adding value to the business every day. And we're really excited about that because, you know, they're going to go from the kind of salary that one makes in a call center to life-changing economic stability. And that's huge. Now,
yeah,
like my goal is in 2 years, they'll be able to get a senior business operations program manager role at any company, and they won't want to leave Zadig. They will stay because we've created this great environment and we've helped them grow. But we're going to create that opportunity for them in their career, and we're all going to benefit from it.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Oh my gosh, I'm excited for that person.
Yeah.
Very cool. Well, thank you so much for sharing, you know, your experience and, you know, all this information on Zadig. It sounds wonderful. I'm so excited to see, you know, what you all are going to do in the next few months and years. Before we leave the interview today, I do want to ask about, you know, your interests outside of the industry. What do you like to do or how do you like to unwind?
I love travel and I love live music. And so I go to a ridiculous number of concerts each year, and some of them I travel for. So in the past, I've gone to Fresno, California to see the Foo Fighters. And I've gone, I go to Bottle Rock, which is a 3-day music festival in Napa Valley every year. And I go to a ton of concerts and I have an amazing time. That's my jam. So travel and live music.
Cool.
Yeah. And when I'm home, gardening.
Awesome. I love gardening too. Do you have a favorite concert that you've been to or?
That's the really, really hard question. Favorite concert. Okay. So there's several, but I'm going to go with one, which is Billy Joel in Madison Square Garden. And the reason it's my favorite is it was in February of 2020. And my firstborn child had just turned 16. Aww. We did college tours. Their birthday gift was tickets to Hamilton. And then we went and saw Billy Joel, which was amazing. I've loved Billy Joel my whole life. And it was a great show and lots of singing along. About 3 weeks later, the world shut down for COVID.
Right.
And so that concert, like that whole trip memory, helped like emotionally buffer me through a year of isolation. So it is sort of that emotional touchstone for me. And most of the concerts I've been to have some sort of big feeling associated with them like that. So that's why it's hard to pick. But that one's my favorite today.
Oh, my goodness. As you're saying, I was just like, and that means for that year, there was no live music, right?
Right, right. Oh. And on average, I go to, if you count Bottle Rock, even though that's a 3-day festival, if you count that as one concert, I go to 15 to 20 concerts a year.
Oh my gosh.
So, yeah, it's my bucket list of things now that, you know, I'm a grown up. I'm making up for lost time and going to all the concerts.
What was the first concert you went to after COVID? Or I guess we're still in COVID, I know.
So I think the first post-COVID concert might have been Elton John, or it might have been Bottle Rock of 2022. So yeah, it was one of those two. In either case, it's a go big or go home.
Yeah, I need to look up Bottle Rock. I actually haven't heard of that.
Oh, it's a blast. It's really good. I have seen everyone from Wu-Tang Clan and Lizzo to this cool Afro-Cuban artist, Sima Funk, which was a blast. I saw a German marching band that does EDM music called Mute. But I've also seen like Bastille and Red Hot Chili Peppers and there's so much diverse music. I would highly recommend it.
That's all at Bottle Rock.
It's all at Bottle Rock, and it's over Memorial Day weekend. So it's coming up next month.
That is so cool. I'm going to check this out for sure. Yeah. I don't know if I'll be able to go, but I definitely want to learn more about that. So thank you so much for sharing.
No problem. Yeah. If nothing else, get on the mailing list for next year.
Yeah, for sure. And you're going this year.
I am.
Like, cool.
We bought our tickets last year.
Excellent.
So, yeah.
is it one of those things where you gotta plan way in advance like that?
Yes and no. The three day passes do end up selling out. So I would definitely do that. And of course, hotels can be a bit dicey. It's like going to San Francisco during RSA. But, you know, if you plan ahead, you can get some decent deals still.
Okay. Very cool. Well, thank you so much for sharing all that with us. This was a great discussion, and I appreciate you joining me today and, you know, sharing your background and insights in the industry.
No problem. This is why I love podcasts. They're just fun.
They are fun. Where can people find you?
So I'm mostly on LinkedIn these days. I haven't found a new social media home. So LinkedIn would be the best place if people want to pick up the conversation post podcast.
Cool. I will definitely direct people there in our show notes. Thanks so much for being here today, Kimberly. I really appreciate it. And we hope to have you back in the future.
Thank you so much. I would be happy to.
Great. Well, bye now. Thank you.
Bye.
That's about all we have for this week. You can find us on Twitter at Domain Tools. All of the articles and IOCs mentioned today will be included in our blog post, which can be found at domaintools.com/resources/podcasts. Catch us every Wednesday at 9 a.m. Pacific time when we publish our podcast and blog. We'll see you next week on another episode of Breaking Badness. Until then, remember, don't drink and click.